Important aspects are, of course, economic institutions, in particular, central banks' independence, mandate, and policies. For this purpose, we have organized this conference. This conference is not to talk about Chile, it's to learn about the world. In particular, we want to learn from other countries, countries that we used to look like examples of good and well-grounded monetary policy. But also, it's useful to look at the variety of experiences, how they integrate the different components of central bank independence and governance, given their particular political, social, and historical circumstances. It is an honor to have an impressive lineup of great central bankers. I'm very grateful for their willingness and generosity to contribute to this discussion. I understand some of them will not be able to participate in the whole meeting because of other commitments, but we are extremely grateful for their participation. The conference will be divided in two panels, the first on institutional mandates, policy tools, and policy coordination, and the second on democratic accountability, transparency, and communications. If time allows, there will be some questions at the end of each panel. I would like now to introduce the governor of the Central Bank of Chile, Mario Marcel, who will moderate the first panel. There is no need for presenting him. He is well known for all of us for his long career in public service. And we have had the privilege of having him leading the board of the Central Bank in a very difficult period with domestic social unrest, the tragedy of the pandemic, and now the resurgence of inflation. The bank has implemented bold policies that have decisively contributed to mitigate the effects of these events and navigate in very turbulent waters. So Mario, now, thanks for your participation. The floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much, Jose. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you. I would like to thank the Faculty of Economics and Administration for organizing this event that would allow us to address these important issues that, as Jose mentioned, are pretty much in the forefront today in Chile, and where, as with many policy and institutional issues, there is a lot of appetite to learn from other countries, not just see what we have, but also to see how things operate elsewhere. It's great to see good friends with whom we have been meeting over the last few years, and including also José de Gregorio, with whom we shared a small room as research assistants in at Cieplan, like I don't know, 30 something years ago. So without further ado, I would like to introduce the first panelist, Esther George, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. She holds a bachelor's degree in business administration from Missouri Western State University and a master's in business administration from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She is also a graduate of the American Bankers Association Stonier Graduate School of Banking and the Stanford University Executive Program. And she is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. She has held this job since 2011 and leads a workforce of close to 2,000 employees in Kansas City and its branch offices in Omaha, Denver, and Oklahoma City. The Kansas City Fed is responsible for conducting monetary policy, providing financial services to depository institutions and the U.S. Treasury, supervising nearly 1,000 banking organizations within the 10th Federal Reserve District, a several state region that includes Western Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Colorado, Wyoming, and Northern New Mexico. As the region's representative of the Federal Open Market Committee in Washington, President George participates in monetary policy deliberations and provides a perspective based on three decades of experience as a banking supervisor. President George also leads the development of the FedNow service that provides financial institutions with the ability to settle payments in real time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And of course, she hosts the annual Jackson Hole Economic Policy Symposium that is followed everywhere in the world every year. So thank you very much for joining us, Esther, and now the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great opportunity to join you. I want to thank the organizers for including me in this very important issue around central bank independence and our mandates. I don't have to tell this group that history has shown that insulating central banks from the inevitable pressure of political dynamics is an important aspect of achieving economic stability for a country's citizens, even as our domestic priorities support a variety of different institutional frameworks and structures. So today I'm going to focus on central banking in the United States, beginning with some historical context on the Federal Reserve's governance structure and its institutional mandate. I'm also going to talk about the evolution of the Federal Reserve's approach to achieving its mandate, and I'll include in that some thoughts on the role of financial stability considerations in the setting of monetary policy. At the time of the Federal Reserve's founding, if you read history, you'll know that the United States had already witnessed two unsuccessful attempts at establishing a central bank. The First Bank of the United States and then its successor, the Second Bank of the United States. And there was intense political debate around the creation of these two banks because Americans in general were very skeptical and distrustful about creating such a powerful and centralized institution. And as a result, neither was able to outlast their initial 20-year charters. In the early 1900s, of course, after a series of financial crises, a third effort was launched to establish a central bank. And this time, there were two overarching themes that emerged during the deliberations about this institution's structure and governance. On one side were those who supported a decentralized structure under the control of the private sector. And on the other side were those who believed that the system should be highly centralized under government control. Eventually, Congress accepted a compromise proposal from President Woodrow Wilson to create a central bank that would have a combined public and private structure, with those roles filled respectively by a board of governors of the Federal Reserve System and the 12 regional reserve banks. As part of that design, the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the monetary policymaking body of the Federal Reserve, consists of 12 members. Seven of those members are the board of governors and five reserve bank presidents. This unique public-private structure was designed to provide a full representation of national interest in the formulation of monetary policy. And in my own view, the Federal Reserve has been well served by the diversity of views inherent to that unique structure. I also think that the Federal Reserve can best achieve its mandates as an independent agency that makes decisions based on the best available evidence and analysis free of political interference. That is, Congress sets the monetary policy goals for the Federal Reserve, but also gives the central bank independence in achieving those goals. A careful reading of Federal Reserve history, however, will find episodes when the independence of the Federal Reserve was undermined, and that these were often periods when government spending was elevated. Pressure on the Fed to implement policy supportive of government spending actually goes back to the early years of the central bank. During the First and Second World Wars, the Federal Reserve assumed a subservient role to the Treasury and viewed its primary duty as the financing of military requirements and of production for war purposes. The Treasury made decisions on debt management and the interest rate it would pay to investors, and then the Federal Reserve would absorb any public debt that was not purchased by investors at the fixed rate. After World War II, the Federal Reserve became increasingly uncomfortable with this arrangement as inflation started to rise while interest rates remained fixed at a very low level. Eventually, the Federal Reserve's resistance to continually supporting government spending led to a formal accord with the Treasury in 1951. And that accord eliminated the obligation of the Federal Reserve to monetize the debt of the Treasury at a fixed rate. It did not, however, eliminate political pressures on the Fed to hold rates low. And you can look back over time and see a list of events that includes such high-profile instances as pressure from President Lyndon Johnson to hold rates low as a means of supporting his proposals during the Vietnam War, and to calls for the Federal Reserve in the case of Paul Volcker's tenure, when he was asked to resign during the Federal Reserve System's successful but very painful battle against high inflation in the early 1980s. Even so, the Treasury-Fed Accord became essential to the independence of central banking in this country and how monetary policy is pursued by the Federal Reserve today. Let me talk a little bit about the mandate of the Fed, because we operate under a directive from the U.S. Congress that we widely refer to as our dual mandate. And that is to foster economic conditions that achieve stable prices and a maximum level of sustainable employment. That mandate, however, has evolved considerably during the past century. At our founding in 1913, the Federal Reserve's central purpose was to furnish an elastic currency and also to establish a more effective supervision of banking in the United States. By the 1940s, with the Great Depression in mind and the U.S. economy transitioning out of the production of wartime goods, Congress passed the Employment Act of 1946, which called for federal government policy to promote maximum employment, production, and purchasing power. By the 1970s, reports of sustained inflation and high unemployment led to the enactment of the Federal Reserve Reform Act of 1977. That law explicitly set price stability as a national policy goal, and it directed the Federal Reserve to maintain long-run growth of monetary and credit aggregates that would be commensurate with the economy's long-run potential to increase production, so as to promote the goals of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. In general, the Fed's dual mandate for maximum employment and price stability we consider to be complementary. A strong commitment to price stability reduces fluctuations in economic activity and helps achieve maximum employment and sustainable economic growth in the long run. Occasionally, there are times when those goals, though, are not complementary. For example, the economy saw both high inflation and high unemployment in the 1970s. And not surprisingly, the Fed came under intense political pressure during that period as it weighed the balance between its inflation and employment mandates. As economic conditions have changed over time, so has the conduct of monetary policy. Most recently, in August of 2020, the Federal Reserve concluded a monetary policy framework review that was launched prior to the pandemic. You'll recall the purpose of the review was to reassess how to conduct monetary policy and achieve our dual mandate in a low interest rate environment. In recent years, interest rates had fallen to historically low levels, not just in the United States, of course, but around the world. And these lower rates, at least partially, I think, reflect structural changes to the economy, including higher savings by households and businesses in an aging society. And of course, low interest rates compose a constraint on a central bank's ability to stabilize the economy during an economic downturn. In addition, the link between the pace of economic activity and inflation appears to have weakened. In the years leading up to the pandemic, inflation remained persistently low, even as the unemployment rate neared record lows. This led some to be concerned that persistently low inflation could lead households and businesses to shift down their inflation expectations, which then potentially could set inflation on a downward spiral and further constrain policy space for the central bank. So in response to those kinds of changes, the Federal Reserve revised its monetary policy framework last year along two important dimensions. The first of those was, in the absence of signs of sustained upward pressure on inflation, the FOMC would not tighten its policy stance simply in response to low unemployment rates. The second was that the committee would aim to target an inflation rate that averages 2% over time. And that is, in the case of inflation falling persistently below 2%, the FOMC would allow inflation to run moderately above 2% for a period of time. And here I would note it's important that even with those revisions, monetary policy is conducted by way of a framework rather than a rule. This is important because the structure of the economy evolves over time in ways that can be difficult to anticipate. And so the flexibility of the framework allows the FOMC to adapt to new circumstances and thereby strengthen its credibility. This is certainly true today as the United States economy recovers from an unprecedented shock. With extraordinary fiscal support, as well as potential structural changes to the economy and labor markets stemming from the pandemic, economic dynamics could evolve quite differently now than we've seen in the past. And so the Fed is likely to best maintain its credibility by remaining nimble and attentive to economic conditions as we seek to achieve our dual mandate. Let me talk just briefly about financial stability, because essential to the conduct of monetary policy and the achievement of our mandated objectives is a stable financial system. Prior to the creation of the Fed, U.S. banking panics were a frequent occurrence, and to the founders of the Federal Reserve, the paramount goal was to create a monetary system that could respond effectively to stresses in the banking system, and of course, to serve as a lender of last resort in a banking crisis. Today, you won't find financial stability in the Federal Reserve's statutory mandate, unlike the mandate of others, including the Central Bank of Chile. However, even without a mandate, it is well understood that financial system risk can impede the attainment of the FOMC's objectives for inflation and employment. Particularly in a prolonged low-rate environment, the concern is increased risk appetites and the rise in asset values. And so incorporating financial stability concerns into our monetary policy deliberations can help to build a more resilient system and, I think, better achieve our mandated goals. I should say here that identifying financial system risk is, of course, important. It is also difficult, given the constant evolution of our financial system and the associated vulnerabilities. Technological change, financial innovation are introducing new risks that require monitoring. So if you think everything from stable coins to the risk associated with climate change, judging the vulnerabilities that can derail financial stability requires flexibility and nimbleness on the part of central banks. Equally important, I think, is understanding what tools exist to address financial stability concerns. Monetary policy settings are not well suited, in my view, to be the primary tool for maintaining financial stability, although clearly the stance of monetary policy has implications for financial stability. And while macroprudential approaches are desirable in theory, deploying macroprudential policy in a timely and potent manner, at least in the case of the United States, has proved to be very challenging. So let me close by saying, as economies and financial systems evolve, the case for central bank independence, I think, is likely to remain strong. Domestic considerations and priorities undoubtedly will dictate the context and the parameters of that independence. But the benefits of separating decisions regarding the stance of monetary policy from political considerations are likely to serve the long-term interest of governments and their citizens everywhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Esther, for that excellent overview of how the Federal Reserve system works, and particularly how independence is exercised for the achievement of its goals. I think that it was very important that you also provided this historical perspective, because when dealing with institutions, there is a temptation to do a sort of comparative studies, but understanding how you got into the current structure is particularly relevant, especially when, like in Chile, we are discussing a new constitution. Hmm? One issue that you emphasize, I think, is important to underscore, which is the notion that in order to reconcile or dealing with multiple objectives, working or conducting monetary policy on the basis of a framework rather than a rigid rule is very useful to that end. And perhaps I could add that in the case of the Federal Reserve, that is formally translated into this statement of on longer run goals and monetary policy strategy that was that captured the result of this assessment that you did over the last couple of years. So there is also a formal way of stating how you are going to work within which framework you will work in the over the next few years. Hmm? Okay, so now we can move to the next panelist, Philip Lowe, the governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Philip holds a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a bachelor's degree in economics and econometrics with honors from the University of New South Wales. He has authored many papers, including several of them on the linkages between monetary policy and financial stability, which is pretty relevant to our discussion, given that many central banks have these dual objectives. He's a chair of the Reserve Bank Board and Payment System Board and chair of the Council of Financial Regulators. He's a member of the Financial Stability Board. And prior to his current role that he started in 2016, he held the positions of deputy governor, assistant governor for economic, and assistant governor for financial system. He's a chair of Financial Markets Foundation for Children and a director of the Annika Foundation. He is also chair of the Committee on the Global Financial System of the Bank for International Settlements, where he submits his reports every 2 months when we meet over there. And perhaps I should underscore that for Philip to join us, he's joining at 6:30 in the morning in Australia, and it's 6:30 of October 22nd, who happens to be my birthday. So I could start celebrating with you as we communicate. So, Philip, thank you very much for joining us. I think the Australian experience is very interesting to us, given this issue of mandates. And now the floor is yours to present this an overview on Australia as well.
Thank you very much, Mario, and happy birthday for tomorrow, and well, happy birthday for today on this side of the Pacific. It's great to be able to join you, and thank you to both you and Jose for the invitation to participate in what's an important conference. You're addressing really critically important issue, and I appreciate the opportunity to share Australia's experience with you. At the outset, I want to acknowledge that there's no single right answer to the issues that you're grappling with. Ultimately, what matters are results, and I think the evidence shows that the probability of a country achieving good results is enhanced if you get the structure around the central bank right. That structure includes the legal mandate of the central bank, the mechanisms for accountability, the way the political system works, and the process for appointing the individuals to the central bank. And the most effective combination of these elements is going to vary from country to country, so there's no single right answer. In Australia's case, the key elements of the central bank mandate were passed into law in 1959, and they've remained unchanged since then. the 1959 legislation set out three objectives for the RBA's monetary policy. So we don't have a dual mandate, we have a triple mandate. And the three elements of that mandate are, first, the stability of the currency, which is widely interpreted as low and stable inflation. The second element is full employment. And the third element is the economic welfare and prosperity of the Australian people. So it's a very broad mandate. Under this legislation, we've had many different monetary policy regimes. We've had a fixed exchange rate against the US dollar, a fixed exchange rate against a trade-weighted index, an adjustable peg against the trade-weighted index, monetary targeting, and since the early 1990s, flexible inflation targeting. This experience illustrates that legislation is only part of the story, with our broad legislation accommodating a very wide variety of monetary policy regimes. In Australia, the choice about the exchange rate regime is one that's made by the government. In my view, that's as it should be, as the choice of exchange rate regime has very wide-ranging implications for how a country's economic system works. In our case, the decision by the government to float the Australian dollar in 1983 has helped reshape the Australian economy in a very positive fashion. The floating exchange rate has also proven to be a great stabiliser of our economy, particularly in the face of large swings in our terms of trade caused by sometimes very large movements in commodity prices, an issue that Chile shares with us. While the Australian government determines the exchange rate regime, it's the RBA that makes decisions about intervention in the market. We rarely intervene, and we are transparent regarding the conditions under which we would intervene. In particular, we would only intervene if market liquidity is significantly deteriorated during a period of stress, or the exchange rate has moved a long way from fundamentals with damaging consequences for the economy. The last time the RBA intervened in the foreign exchange market was during the global financial crisis, so more than 13 years ago. So intervention is very unusual, and I'd say becoming increasingly unusual. We do not have an objective for the exchange rate, nor would it make sense for us to do so. In my view, adding an exchange rate objective to the central bank's other objectives would severely compromise the achievement of those other objectives and produce, on average, poorer results. Turning now to the inflation objective, Australia was an early adopter of flexible medium-term inflation targeting. From the outset, our target has been for the CPI inflation rate to average between 2 and 3% over time. We focused on the medium term rather than the outcome in a particular year or the outcome over a specific forecast horizon. We never bought into the idea that the central bank needed to be placed in a straitjacket or surrounded by an electric fence to stop it from exploiting the short-run Phillips curve. We've always had a flexible approach that allows for some variation in inflation from year to year. While financial markets are often very concerned about whether inflation in a given year is 1.7% or 2.3%, most people in the real economy rightly don't focus too much on this. Most of us have better things to worry about. What matters for overall welfare is that people are confident their savings and their income will not be eaten away by inflation. It's also important that saving and investment decisions can be made without inflation figuring prominently on people's radar screens. There are various ways of achieving this, but we have found a flexible medium-term inflation target works well. In terms of the formalities, Australia's inflation target is not set out in legislation. It was originally set by the central bank, but soon after this, it was codified in a written agreement between the central bank and the government. The agreement is reviewed whenever there is a change of government or a change in the central bank governor. Over the 25 years since the first agreement was signed, the language has evolved considerably, but the numerical target of 2 to 3% on average has been maintained, and so too has the focus on the medium term. From my perspective, this arrangement has a couple of advantages. First, it enhances the credibility of the monetary policy regime as it demonstrates that the inflation target is owned by both the government and the central bank. Second, it offers a degree of flexibility as the target is not set in stone. The target and the accompanying language can be changed if both the central bank and the government agree. As we've seen in Australia, the language can change over time. The other elements of the RBA's mandate are full employment and the economic prosperity and welfare of the people of Australia. In terms of full employment, we do not have a numerical target, and I don't think it makes sense to do so. Experience has taught us that the Nairu moves over time, and it's influenced by many factors outside the control of the central bank. I think the same can be said for the estimate of the employment to population ratio that's consistent with full employment and stable inflation. Setting the wrong targets here would create a conflict with the inflation target, which would lead to monetary policy uncertainty and poor economic outcomes. Despite the difficulty of setting a numerical target here, I'm a strong supporter of the RBA's broad mandate, as I said, which includes not just full employment, but also the economic prosperity of the people of Australia. And I say this from two perspectives. The first relates to communication. I see a benefit in the central bank being able to communicate that it cares about more than just inflation control. To be clear, inflation control is and always needs to be at the core of what a central bank does. But ultimately, inflation control is only a means to an end. And that end is a productive economy with people enjoying economic and financial stability, having jobs and achieving a high level of economic welfare. Having a broad mandate allows the central bank to pursue and articulate its goals in these broader terms. This can help build trust in the central bank over time and support public confidence in its decisions. That's not to say that a broad mandate is required for the central bank to speak in these terms, but I think it makes it easier to do so. The second perspective is that a broad mandate can provide an extra degree of freedom in responding to economic shocks. This is especially so in the case of supply shocks, when output and inflation move in different directions. A broad mandate can allow the central bank more time to return inflation to target following shocks that push inflation away from target. Provided that the inflation target's credible, this flexibility can be used in a way that does not prejudice the achievement of medium-term price stability. Importantly, the flexibility can help reduce the amplitude of cycles in activity and employment, and it can also have the benefit of reducing financial stability risks, especially if cutting interest rates in response to a positive supply shock and lower inflation encourages excessive borrowing and asset overvaluation. Again, I want to make it clear that the central bank does not need a broad mandate to have this flexibility. It's possible that a central bank with an inflation-only mandate could achieve the same results, especially if it has a flexible rather than a rigid inflation target. The other topic for this session was the coordination arrangements with the government. I've already spoken about the agreement on the inflation target, so I'd like to touch on four other aspects of the relationship between the Reserve Bank of Australia and the Australian government. First, the government appoints all members of the Reserve Bank Board, which is the decision-making body for monetary policy. The governor has a seven-year term and often serves a longer term. Other board members are appointed for at least 5 years, and they often serve multiple terms. Beside the governor and the deputy governor, all members of the board are external to the central bank, and they're prominent members of the business, academic, or policy communities. The secretary to the Australian Treasury, who's the most senior public servant in the Treasury Department, is also a full voting member of the board. The secretary participates as an economist in their own right, not as a representative of the government, but he or she is able to share details of the government's fiscal and other plans. The board is apolitical, and there is not a tradition of board members stepping down following a change of government. board members, including me, can have their appointments terminated only if they become permanently incapacitated, become bankrupt, miss too many meetings, or fail to satisfy their obligations regarding the governance of a public sector entity. These termination provisions have never been used, and they're not a point of controversy. Second, there is a frequent exchange of views between the central bank and the treasurer, as the representative of the government. This exchange is mostly on an informal basis as circumstances require. The treasurer does not attend meetings of the board, nor has the right to do so. The government and the opposition both support the independence of the central bank. And when the government is asked about monetary policy, the typical response is that monetary policy is a matter for the independent Reserve Bank and the government doesn't offer its own comment. Third, the RBA is the transactional banker for the Australian government. In that role, it provides the government with a small overdraft facility that can be used only to deal with unexpected mismatches in the timing of government payments and receipts. While there's nothing in Australia's central bank law that prevents lending to the government, there is a long-standing written agreement that the central bank will not provide such finance. Furthermore, the government has no role to play in the RBA's decisions about its bond purchase program. These decisions are taken independently by the RBA's board. Fourth, the Reserve Bank Act includes provisions for dealing with a situation in which there is a fundamental difference of opinion between the government and the central bank. In such a circumstance, the law states that the central bank is required to set out its position in writing. The government could then order the bank to adopt a particular policy. If the government did this, it would then need to set out all the relevant documents before both houses of parliament within 15 sitting days. So there'd be a very high level of transparency about what was going on. I want to point out that these provisions have never been used. They effectively operate as a safeguard against the possibility of the independent central bank pursuing a policy that would be damaging to the national interest. In my view, there is a strong case for such a safeguard in a parliamentary democracy, especially one in which there is both a focus on institutions being accountable to the parliament and a long tradition of political respect for policy-making institutions. Exercising this power would be a very major political step, and it would draw strong interest from the media and from financial markets, so it's not something that would be done lightly. As I said, it's never been done. At its core, the relationship between the government and the central bank in Australia is one based on constructive dialogue. This is reflected in the agreement regarding the inflation target I spoke about earlier and the frequent discussions on issues of mutual interest. The government also supports a high level of transparency by the RBA, including through publications and speeches and public appearances before parliamentary oversight committees. I want to finish, Amaro, where I started, and that is that there is no right answer to the questions that Chile is grappling with. But Australia's experience is that a combination of a freely floating exchange rate, a flexible medium-term inflation target, and a broad mandate for the central bank can work well for a small open economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philip. I think that you addressed the whole spectrum of institutional dimensions of the Federal Reserve Board, but also giving a sense of what things are more frequently used, or those that are statutory but have not been used in history. So when you're discussing a constitution or a framework legislation, that is an important part of the picture. Things that actually are more binding, and others that are only for very exceptional circumstances that may not be generated. And I think that the point that you made at the very beginning, that the same framework can be home to different rules, is very important. Our policy regimes, you said, because that's the nature of a constitution, to provide a broader framework, but the policy has to develop within that, and the policy regime is the way of providing a structure to those policy decisions. Okay, so now we turn to Alejandro Díaz de León, the governor of the Bank of Mexico. Alejandro has a master's degree in public and private administration from the Yale School of Management, specializing in financial engineering and valuation of derivative and fixed income instruments. He has developed an extensive professional career linked to the Bank of Mexico since 1991, working in areas such as the Securities Market Studies Subdivision, Financial System Analysis Subdivision, Macro Financial Analysis, Macro Analysis and Economic Studies. In 2007, he was appointed as a General Director of the National Pension Fund for Workers in the government. He was head of the Debt Management Office at the Ministry of Finance and General Director of the National Bank of Foreign Trade. In addition, Alejandro is the author of several publications published by the Bank of Mexico and other institutions, has participated in many collegiate bodies in developing banking and financial authorities. He was appointed by Mexico's president to serve as governor of the Bank of Mexico from December 1st, 2017. Alejandro, the floor is yours to share your experience and your institutional structure for the central bank in Mexico.
Please go ahead. Thank you very much, Mario and Jose, for the invitation. It is an honor, and thank you to the Universidad de Chile for being part of this conference. Central banks are unique institutions. They all share the responsibility of providing our countries with national currency, and money is an essential public good that needs to be an effective medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. Societies have found that the best form of money is not that which provides intrinsic value, but that which, although immaterial, fiat money, given the rules and strategies followed by its issuer, ensures the issuer's commitment to pursue society's long-term goals. The mandate, goals, and objectives defined by society for central banks determine the strategies and terms and conditions by which they provide money to their national economies. This clearly represents an issue of sovereignty and social contract of utmost importance. Countries may set different priorities to take specific elements into consideration. To a certain extent, central bank mandates are usually influenced by the most adverse monetary episodes previously experienced by each country. For example, Germany's in the 1920s hyperinflation must have influenced their society's search for price stability, as the Great Depression may have raised employment consideration in the US Federal Reserve's dual mandate. In the case of many central banks in Latin America, between the late 70s and early 90s, many economies in the region experienced periods of high inflation. Since that time, concerns have been that central banks under political influence tend to set expansionary policies to finance governments and stimulate short-term economic growth, regardless of the medium and long-run consequences. This was the main reason why it was necessary to isolate monetary policymaking from direct political influence. Many central banks in Latin America and in other regions were thus granted independence, with mandates set mainly on pursuing price stability. In this context, Chile was one of the first economies to modernize its monetary policy framework with this objective. Central bank independence requires an institutional setup that sometimes involves making political, unpopular decisions, but which are intended for the long-run benefit of the country. Its key features are, first, a clear legal mandate and specific objectives. Second, limiting the government's discretionary power of appointing central bank governing board members. Three, limiting the ability of any government authority to use central bank as a source of financing. Four, consolidate collegiate decision-making bodies with proven technical capacity and the guarantee to act independently. And fifth, allowing the central bank to choose the best means to achieve the objectives set by law. The paradigm of autonomous, flexible inflation targeting central banks was the result of society's recognition at that time that the central bank's best contribution to long-term growth was to maintain sustained price stability, and that monetary policy should deliver long-run inflation around a specific defined target with non-persistent fluctuations in inflation. This clearly recognizes the notion that there is no exploitable trade-off between inflation and real variables. Even though most central banks have price stability mandates, the sharp contractions in economic activity experienced during the global financial crisis and the current COVID-19 pandemic have led to the revision of the adequate monetary policy mandate and also some of the frameworks. Theoretically, economic models point unequivocally towards optimal monetary policy strategies that minimize fluctuations around inflation target and around the potential output. The key question is which central bank institutional framework, mindful of political economy considerations, delivers such outcome. In this regard, when an economy faces inflationary pressures from aggregate demand, monetary authorities with a single or dual mandate operate to stabilize inflation and output gaps. However, more challenging scenarios in which these gaps move in opposite directions may take place. In this context, central banks would face a complex trade-off regardless of their mandates. Under a dual mandate, these institutions are likely to face strong pressure to prioritize economic activity concerns in spite of the presence of a positive inflation gap. As an example, the ECB, whose primary objective is to maintain price stability in the euro area when facing supply-related disturbances, conducts monetary policy aimed at achieving a gradual and orderly convergence of inflation to its target while avoiding a sharp fall in economic activity and employment. In advanced economies, inflation dynamics are better anchored around their targets, and they are mainly driven by aggregate demand dynamics. Under these conditions, a dual mandate could be regarded as a useful way to explain the central bank's reaction function. Emerging economies face additional challenges. First, while they have strengthened their macroeconomic policy frameworks and improved their economic fundamentals over the last decades, and despite their great advances in controlling inflation, many of them have not fully consolidated an environment of low and stable inflation, and medium and long-term inflation expectations are not fully anchored at the target. Monetary policies is still in the process of attaining these goals. Second, emerging economies face larger and more frequent inflationary shocks and thus have historically registered higher inflation levels and expectations higher to bring back to target. Three, they are predominantly small open economies whose terms of trade are strongly influenced by commodity prices. They are also open to capital flows and thus subject to variation in investor sentiment and global risk aversion. For these reasons, they are highly exposed to fluctuations in global economic and financial conditions, which in turn is reflected in a large exchange rate volatility and infrequent inflationary shocks. Moreover, consumer price indices in these economies have larger weights on the prices of volatile items such as food and energy. As a result, inflation is on average more volatile and more difficult to forecast than in advanced economies. To illustrate this point, let me highlight that recent research done at Banco de Mexico suggests that on average, shocks to the output gap have explained only about 10% of the variation of core inflation across Latin American countries since the early 2000s. On the other hand, exchange rate shocks account for almost 24% of the variation, idiosyncratic inflationary shocks originating from government authorized prices, weather factors, and so on, account for more than 60%, and commodity price shocks account for the remaining variation. When there are insufficiently credible inflation targets, and inflation dynamics is dominated by foreign exchange and supply related shocks, a well-defined and broadly understood and communicated single mandate can better contribute to reduce uncertainty about the central bank's reaction function and reduce term premium. In this case, the central bank can commit to a low and stable inflation around its target while avoiding spillovers on economic activity and employment. For emerging economies facing these conditions and adopting a dual mandate could require a tighter monetary policy stance to compensate for the added uncertainty in the reaction function and its effect on both inflation and term premium. When central banks in emerging economies face a complex policy trade-off because inflation and output gaps are moving in opposite directions, they have to ensure that monetary policy does not lead to increases in term premium and induce a steeper yield curve. In this circumstance, a dual mandate could add that uncertainty to the policy response and put pressure on inflation risk premium. Under these conditions, emerging economies could be better served by a well-defined single mandate centered on price stability to directly contain inflation expectations and risk premium. There is an additional challenge faced by emerging economies, especially in Latin America, where there is a significant economic growth deficit that over the last decade has resulted in a lower per capita GDP relative to other emerging and advanced economies. Even in the case of Mexico, we have seen a reduction of potential GDP over the last years. In this environment, political pressures seeking to have stimulus and higher growth will not be put to rest by an update of potential GDP that it is a non-observable variable. Thus, in these economies, central banks are bound to face greater pressures to put aside long-term price stability concerns and provide a short-term stimulus to the economy. Summing up, under the current setting, an institutional mandate that is attainable, time-consistent, and allows society to make policymakers accountable for their actions by having them build credibility in their commitment to their goals is fundamental. In the specific case of Mexico, monetary policy has been conducted to achieve a primary price stability mandate. This approach has led to direct benefits such as lower inflation, lower exchange rate pass-through, stable inflation expectations, and lower term premia, and indirectly to other beneficial changes in the economy, such as the development of long-term financial instruments. It is important to underline that a central bank by itself cannot achieve macroeconomic stability. Coordination and communication between both monetary and fiscal policies is crucial to achieve success, and Mexico has had a successful experience cooperating with the Treasury. Of utmost importance is that this approach has allowed Banco de Mexico to remain a strong public institution and sustain its independence with legitimacy in the eyes of the public. In this regard, central banks, especially in emerging economies, must also play the role of an anchor, both in economic and institutional frameworks, and with a clear, attainable mandate that contributes to strengthen these institutions. Overall, while the ultimate goal of any central bank is and must be to contribute to the welfare of society, there is no unique institutional design that fits all economies at all times. Authorities and legislators have to consider multiple elements based on the historical experience of each country, the nature of the shocks faced by their economies, and any other likely pressures that institutions may face under diverse circumstances. In sum, long-term oriented institutions, including central banks, now more than ever need to be designed thoughtfully and particularly must have a clear, time-consistent mandate that allows for good decision-making for the benefit of our societies. Thank you very much, Mario.
Thank you very much, Alejandro. I think your presentation was particularly useful to us as coming from an emerging economy in our same region. And you raised a very important point, which is that one should think of mandates and institutional frameworks that are consistent with the structural nature of the economy. So when we usually say that there is no one size fits all, in the case of emerging economies, that means taking into account that our relationship with the outside the world on issues like dependence or the impact of terms of trade, capital flows, and so on, are very important. That's something that one should keep in mind in looking at comparing institutions across countries. Okay, we have a couple of minutes left. I know that we are very close to the allotted time for this panel, but I think that Dean De Gregorio may have a question for you, taken from the ones that came from the audience. But I would ask you to keep shorting the answers so as not to eat time from the next panel. So,
I think that the most important issue today, and most of people is asking everywhere, is what your view on the challenges of monetary policy and central banking facing this inflationary shock as we are living the pandemic. So I think that it's a quite a first order issue in monetary policy today around the world. So if you can tell us something about your views and views that later on we'll know from your central bank decisions. So I don't know if some of the, is there?
I mean, I'll just be very brief, Jose. So certainly we have spent how many of the past decades where the public didn't think about inflation. Inflation was low and stable. Central bankers were paying more attention to, at least in the case of the U.S., trying to make sure inflation was hitting their 2% inflation targets. And you contrast that today, where now we have the public quite attentive to the levels of inflation that are coming out of this recovery with labor shortages and supply constraints, and central banks trying to refocus people on the long run as opposed to the short run. So it is a very challenging time in judging what is a near-term issue as it relates to inflation versus a long-term issue. And at the same time, not wanting to take our eye off is what is a central mandate for us, and that is making sure that we achieve price stability over the long run. So indeed challenging, and something my colleagues and I are spending a lot of time, both in a communication standpoint, as well as assessing the risk to the long run outlook for the economy.
Thank you very much. Alejandro Filipos, if you want to say.
Yes. I would just say very quickly, this is a very peculiar shock that we are facing. This is not the traditional supply shock. I think the pandemic is a very peculiar shock that it is introducing not only these bottleneck issues on the supply side, but also a significant shift from expenditure, from consumer expenditures, household expenditure, towards durable goods. So we are spending all less in services and more on durable goods. How long will that shift in demand will take to process? How the price dynamic that will be? I think that is an open challenge. We are of the view that the shocks are to be transitory. Nonetheless, the risk for inflation have increased. The policy space, as in the fiscal side, in the monetary side, something similar. Emerging markets, we have significantly less space than advanced economies. We have not had inflation below our targets for the last 20 years or so. So in our case, we have to be more mindful about price formation and the contamination of inflation expectations. And that's why we have been, trying to reduce monetary accommodation already as a way to improve our chances of having an orderly adjustment and not having inflation expectations being contaminated.
Thank you very much, Alejandro.
Thank you, and I agree very much with Esther's assessment. I mean, we're clearly seeing a spike in inflation at the moment, and broadly we understand why that spike's occurring. Whether the spike turns into a permanent lift is going to depend really what happens in the labour market. Because I don't think we're going to have sustainably higher inflation unless we have sustainably higher wages growth, and that's, for me, where the big open question is at the moment. How are labour markets and wage growth going to respond to the spike in inflation? Is it going to reset expectations about what type of wage growth people should get, or will the spike dissipate and we'll go back to the type of labour market outcomes we were seeing before the pandemic? So there's quite a lot of uncertainty around that issue. So that's what we're watching very carefully.
Thank you very much, Phil.